Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
People who are slim, who look slim, but have hidden pockets of fat within their muscles are at increased risk of deadly heart conditions. It's according to new research from a team at Harvard University. And the study examined the health impact of something known as intermuscular fat. That's similar to the fat found in the prized Wagyu beef. Well, here to tell us more, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Paddy Barrett, who's a preventative cardiologist at Blackrock Clinic. Paddy, hello to you.
Morning.
This is dreadful news now. People who are thin, slim, look healthy, could have terrible problems. Is that what we're saying?
Well, kind of, but we've known this for a very long time. So this study just, I think, reinforces something we have known in the community for a long time, that we focus on weight, but and that is a proxy for fat. But in truth, I don't really care about fat. What I care about is fat in the wrong place, causing a metabolic disturbance. And that's what this study really illustrates. So these people were typically of normal weight, but what they had was fat in the wrong place, and that ultimately caused them downstream consequences in terms of an increased risk of heart attack over the years.
So this is intermuscular fat, fat that's inside in the muscle.
Correct. So again, this is all about this distinction of understanding there are different types of fat, and when fat is in the wrong place, it can cause the problems that we're worried about. Where we have historically seen this is that people are familiar with maybe the distinction between what's called subcutaneous fat, that's the fat on your side that you can pinch, but in general that's not that dangerous, but it's the visceral fat that sits inside your major organs like your liver and your kidneys and pancreas, etc., that is the engine of inflammation that drives all this disease. But we're also seeing this in other organs. So it's just another example of this, that fat in muscle tissue, which shouldn't be there, is driving a metabolic consequence and an increased risk of heart disease.
So you could be in the overweight or obese category and not have this intermuscular fat. Is that true?
Correct. That the technical term for that is what's called metabolically healthy obese. And there's been a huge shift in terms of how we're looking at this as a medical issue. Obesity has historically been defined solely based on your BMI, which is a combination of your height and weight. And largely, that is a population metric. So it is useful for describing large numbers of people. So it will be directionally correct, but often specifically inaccurate. We know when people are significantly overweight with very, very enlarged BMIs, if all or most of that excess fat is in their subcutaneous tissue, the actual metabolic consequence, so their increased risk of, say, heart disease, is actually quite small. Now, they're at higher risk in the future, but in general, if all that fat is in their subcutaneous fat on their kind of side and not in their visceral organs or their muscles, their risk is actually only marginally increased.
So what people, I would imagine, really want to know is, how do you know if you have this intermuscular fat?
So again, this is why I go back to, I'm not really interested in weight or fat. I'm interested in the metabolic consequences of fat in the wrong place causing problems. So you have to look for the downstream markers. Your weight or BMI will be, again, directionally helpful, but not specifically correct. So the metabolic markers that we're looking at are things like high blood pressure, diabetes, pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome. Do you have obstructive sleep apnea, which is high correlation with it? Do you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Do you have high triglycerides in your cholesterol panel? Do you have low HDL cholesterol? And so these are all the metabolic consequences of that. So again, it's not about the fat. It's what the fat is causing as a metabolic consequence.
So can people listening to this go to their GP and say, can you tell me if I have intermuscular fat, please?
No.
Okay. So how do you find out?
So I would argue that you don't need to find out. Because again, I'm not interested really in the fat. I'm interested in the downstream consequences. But you can go to your GP and you can say, do I have evidence of metabolic syndrome insofar as high blood pressure, increased waist circumference, low HDL, high triglycerides, evidence of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Do I have obstructive sleep apnea? These are things that we deal with all day long, every single day. And the, I think, frustrating thing is that when you look at all of these different conditions, they can often be managed by different specialties, for example, but they all reflect in large part a commonality, which is excess fat in the wrong place causing a metabolic consequence.
So how do you avoid having that fat in the wrong place?
Well, I think when you actually look at the study, what's important to note is that the biggest predictor of having excess muscular fat was having a higher BMI. So the risk was manifest across all BMI categories, but the biggest the greatest likelihood of having that intramuscular fat was being overweight. The second thing is, in the category of people who were of normal weight who had excess intramuscular fat, the biggest predictor for that is actually not doing adequate exercise or developing enough lean muscle or kind of healthy muscle. Mm-hmm. Because when you also look at that study, one of the protective factors that were identified were actually having higher levels of muscle mass in general, so kind of healthy muscle mass aggregated from exercise, and also, again, having higher levels of subcutaneous adipose tissue. So that's that safe fat on the outside. So what I would argue is this all just speaks to the core fundamentals. People should not try to focus on whether or not they have this specific type of fat that is really only identifiable in research settings. They should look for the downstream consequences and ask, are they doing the appropriate things from nutrition and exercise or any other kind of additional risk reduction strategies to reduce the downstream consequences?
Okay. Is there a reason why some people might develop this intramuscular fat as opposed to the other fat, which makes you appear overweight?
So there's a theory called the personal fat threshold, which basically says that your subcutaneous fat stores are somewhat dictated at birth genetically. And so you, if you think of it like a balloon, so you either have a small balloon or a big balloon. And so for the people with a small balloon, they can put on a small amount of excess weight, but it may exceed the size of that small balloon. And then it basically, the balloon gets damaged and any excess fat goes into the visceral fat stores or ectopic fat stores like muscle. So that is somewhat genetically determined. There are certain people.
They're the people who are not going to look as though they are overweight.
Correct. And we see this in certain kind of categories of people. Southeast Asian populations, they tend to not have significant increases in weight, but it's very significant abnormal metabolic dysfunction with that. And again, it's about looking for the metabolic dysfunction.
So on the other side, then, the people who are genetically disposed to putting the weight on around their body, visible fat, you know, that might be just something that they have to live with.
Well, it's not necessarily live with. It's to do. We have various ways of dialing that up and down. But we always have to ask is, what is your goal in terms of modifying your weight? Are we looking to modify your metabolic health that is actually the big driver of your risk? Or are you looking to change your body shape and composition around aesthetics? Mm-hmm. So we always have to be very careful in terms of what our goal is in terms of what we're trying to achieve.
Okay. So what can people do then to address both of those issues? You're saying that it all comes back to the fundamentals on both sides, whether it's for aesthetics or for your metabolic health, it's the exercise that you're taking and the diet?
So again, you always have to match the tool to the job. When we look at exercise is hands down, bar none, the best predictor of for longevity, but it is terrible at actually helping you to lose weight. But if we look at nutrition, for example, nutrition is one of the best strategies for actually reducing weight. And when we're talking about reducing weight, what we're really talking about is reducing visceral fat levels. Mm-hmm. But we also know that people struggle very significantly with this. This is a global epidemic proportion problem. And we have to match, again, the tool to the job. So for people who are using nutrition and it's working, fantastic. That's great. But for people who are not able to hit their targets, there are additional therapies that everyone's very aware of in the form of Ozempic and all the different GLP-1 agonist classes that actually can be used on a tiered approach.
All right, and you don't have an issue with those being used by people. I mean, you hear a lot of criticism.
Again, it's matching the tool to the job. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to use a medication that comes with potential downstream consequences to change your aesthetics, or are you looking to change your metabolic risk? So this is why I think we will see these medications used more and more for treating metabolic risk rather than to do with excess weight. If you look at individuals who have diabetes, who are relatively normal weight, who lose maybe 5 to 10% of their body weight, they can reverse their diabetes. So again, we're going to take the focus off the significant amounts of excess weight, and we're going to use the target of metabolic dysfunction.
Mm-hmm. If you have a client who is carrying excess weight and they are metabolically healthy, what's your advice to them?
Again, what is their goal? I always go back to the framework that I'm not here to tell people what to do. I'm here to help people hit their goals. And so if their goal is to be metabolically healthy and reduce their cardiovascular risk, you know, we have ways to do that. Now, again, if someone is metabolically healthy and is looking to actually reduce the amount of, say, excess subcutaneous fat, that is an aesthetics thing. That is not something that I spend much time interested in. We we can use the same tools to do it, but we have to be very clear about that is the goal that we're using to do it. And I would argue that using medications that have potential downstream consequences should be used very, very cautiously in someone who's just looking to change their aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And that is where one of the biggest criticisms of these medications are being laid. And I think, you know, reasonably so at the moment, given the landscape.
Okay, what are the downstream consequences then?
So the downstream consequences, largely the same for every medication. There are potential for side effects. About 20% of patients or so will develop kind of nausea, sometimes vomiting, or GI upset or gastrointestinal upset. Very small percentage of patients can develop more serious side effects like pancreatitis, for example. You have to acknowledge that for the majority of people who go on this medication, they're going to be on it indefinitely until basically it gets changed to a different iteration of the therapy, because we know that for the people who stop the medication, the majority of their weight loss comes back. And for people who cycle on and off it, sometimes the effect can be blunted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're using these medications, we have to use them like we use all medications for treating risk that comes with health consequences. And I think we should be very careful about using them to treat simply aesthetics alone. These are medications with risks.
You hear about people having a set weight point, you know, that they might go on some sort of an healthy eating plan or cut out carbs, which we know isn't a good idea, whatever it might be. But once you stop, the weight goes back on. You go back to where you were, or perhaps, you know, an even higher weight. It's the same with these weight loss medications.
Correct. So again, they should be looked at no differently than a blood pressure lowering medication or a cholesterol lowering medication. If you lower someone's metrics with a medication like blood pressure, and then you take away the blood pressure medication, if all things remain the same, taking away the medication will just have their blood pressure go back up mm-hmm. to where it was. And we have to view the concept of obesity in similar terms. Now, if you look at the dietary changes for weight loss, the evidence is quite clear that if you look at the dietary interventions, they do work, and almost all of them work at 6 months. But at 2 years, 50% of people will have regained all their weight. And at 5 years, 80% of people will have regained all of their weight.
Is that because it's so hard to maintain any of those regimes?
It's partly the case in terms of unless you change, you make very radical changes around your life. So, you know, in terms of if you're still having difficulties with sleep because of, say, work or kind of, you know, a variety of different factors, if you're still not giving yourself the time to be able to exercise or focus on nutrition, if those factors, external factors, stay the same, it makes it incredibly hard. But there are set points. There are kind of mechanisms where your body is fighting to hit a target weight. So it becomes harder and harder, maybe the more weight that you lose.
Yeah, so you might still be doing the same thing, but your body is saying, I'm going to hang on to absolutely everything you're putting into me here now, because I know that you're not going to give me the next thing until five, 6 hours down the line.
Correct. There are adaptations that make it harder and harder for people to hit their goals.
Okay. Right. Fascinating, as always. Thank you very much, Paddy, for coming in. That is Paddy Barrett, who is a preventative cardiologist, and Paddy, no doubt, will be back with us very soon.